A check on the residents, Trevor. If they're all in their places, bright, shiny faces optional, then I'll relax. Only she wouldn't. There had been too much relaxation already. 5. Back in her office, she told Rosalind she didn't want to be disturbed unless it was Stackhouse or Zeke Ioannidis, who was currently running a surveillance check on D-level. She sat behind her desk, looking at the screensaver on her computer. It showed a white sand beach on Siesta Key, where she told people she planned to retire. She had given up telling herself that. Mrs. Sigsby fully expected to die here in the woods, possibly in her little house in the village, more likely behind this very desk. Two of her favorite writers, Thomas Hardy and Rudyard Kipling, had died at their desks. Why not her? The Institute had become her life, and she was okay with that. Most of the staff was the same. Once they had been soldiers or security personnel at hard-edged companies like Blackwater and Tomahawk Global, or law enforcement. Denny Williams and Michelle Robertson of the Ruby Red Team had been FBI. If the Institute wasn't their lives when they were recruited and came on station, it became their lives. It wasn't the pay. It wasn't the bennies or the retirement options. Part of it had to do with a manner of living that was so familiar to them it was a kind of sleep. The Institute was like a small military base. The adjacent village even had a PX where they could buy a wide range of goods at cheap prices and gas up their cars and trucks, paying 90 cents a gallon for regular and $1.05 for high test. Mrs. Sigsby had spent time at Ramstein Air Base in Germany, and the town of Denison Riverbend reminded her, on a much smaller scale, granted, of Kaiserslautern, where she and her friends sometimes went to blow off steam. Ramstein had everything, even a twinplex theater and a Johnny Rockets. But sometimes you just wanted to get away. The same was true here. But they always come back, she thought, looking at the sand beach she sometimes visited but where she would never live. They always come back, and no matter how sloppy some things have become around here, they don't talk. That's one thing they are never sloppy about. Because if people found out what we are doing, the hundreds of children we have destroyed, we'd be tried and executed by the dozens, given the needle like Timothy McVeigh. That was the dark side of the coin. The bright side was simple. The entire staff, from the often annoying but undoubtedly competent Dr. Dan Donkey Kong Hendricks and Drs. Heckel and Jekyll in back half, right down to the lowliest janitor, understood that nothing less than the fate of the world was in their hands, as it had been in the hands of those who had come before them. Not just the survival of the human race, but the survival of the planet. They understood there was no limit to what they could and would do in pursuit of those ends. No one who fully grasped the Institute's work could regard it as monstrous. Life here was good. Good enough, anyway, especially for men and women who had eaten sand in the Mideast and seen fellow soldiers lying in shitty villages with their legs blown off or their guts hanging out. You got the occasional furlough. You could go home and spend time with your family, assuming you had one. Many Institute employees did not. Of course, you couldn't talk to them about what you did. And after a while, they, the wives, the husbands, the children, would realize that it was the job that mattered, not them. Because it took you over, your life became, in descending order, the Institute, the village, and the town of Denison Riverbend, with its three bars, one featuring live country music. And once the realization set in, the wedding ring would more often than not come off, as Alverson's had done. Mrs. Sigsby unlocked the bottom drawer of her desk and took out a phone that looked similar to the ones the extraction teams carried. Big and blocky, like a refugee from a time when cassette tapes were giving way to CDs and portable phones were just starting to show up in electronics stores. It was sometimes called the green phone because of its color, and more than often, the zero phone, because there was no screen and no numbers, just three small white circles. I will call, she thought, Maybe they'll applaud my forward thinking and congratulate me on my initiative. Maybe they'll decide I'm jumping at shadows and it's time to think of a replacement. Either way, it has to be done. Duty calls, and it should have called sooner. But not today, she murmured. No, not today. Not while there was Alverson to take care of and dispose of. Maybe not tomorrow or even this week. What she was thinking of doing was no small thing. She would want to make notes, so that when she did call, she could be as on point as possible. If she really meant to use the zero, it was imperative that she be ready to reply concisely when she heard the man at the other end say, "Hello, Mrs. Thigby. How can I help?" It's not the same as procrastinating, she told herself. Not at all. And I don't necessarily want to get anyone in trouble, but... Her intercom gave a soft tone.
I have Zeke for you, Mrs. Sigsby. Line 3.
Mrs. Sigsby picked up. What have you got for me, Ioannidis?
Perfect attendance, he said. 28 locator blips in back half. In front half, there's 2 kids in the lounge, 6 in the playground, 5 in their rooms.
Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome, ma'am.
Mrs. Sigsby got up feeling a little better, although she couldn't have said precisely why. Of course the residents were all accounted for. What had she been thinking? That some of them had gone off to Disney World? Meanwhile, on to the next chore. 6. Once all the residents were at lunch, Fred the janitor pushed a trolley borrowed from the cafeteria kitchen to the door of the room where Maureen Alverson had ended her life. Fred and Stackhouse wrapped her in a swatch of green canvas and rolled her up the corridor double time. From further on came the sound of the animals at feeding time. But here all was deserted, although someone had left a teddy bear lying on the floor in front of the elevator annex. It stared at the ceiling with its glassy shoe-button eyes. Fred gave it an irritated kick. Stackhouse looked at him reproachfully.
Bad luck, pal. That's some child's comfort stuffy.
I don't care, Fred said. They're always leaving the shit around for us to pick up.
When the elevator doors opened, Fred started to pull the trolley in. Stackhouse pushed him back, and not gently.
Your services are not required beyond this point. Pick up that teddy and put it in the lounge or in the canteen where its owner will see it when he or she comes out, and then start dusting those fucking bulbs.
He pointed up at one of the overhead camera housings, rolled the trolley in, and held his card up to the reader. Fred Clark waited until the doors were shut before giving him the finger. But orders were orders, and he'd clean the housings. Eventually. 7. Mrs. Sigsby was waiting for Stackhouse on F level. It was cold down here, and she was wearing a sweater over her suit jacket. She nodded to him. Stackhouse nodded back and rolled the trolley into the tunnel between front half and back half. It was the very definition of utilitarian, with its concrete floor, curved tile walls, and overhead fluorescents. A few of these were stuttering, giving the tunnel a horror movie feel, and a few others were dead out. Someone had pasted a New England Patriots bumper sticker on one wall. More carelessness, she thought. More drift. The door at the back half end of the corridor bore a sign reading, "Authorized Personnel Only." Mrs. Sigsby used her card and pushed it open. Beyond was another elevator lobby. A short upward journey brought them to a lounge only slightly less utilitarian than the service tunnel they had taken to get to back half. Heckle, real name Dr. Everett Hallis, was waiting for them. He was wearing a big grin and constantly touching the corner of his mouth. It reminded Mrs. Sigsby of the Dixon boys' obsessive nose-pulling. Except Dixon was only a kid, and Hallis was in his 50s. Working in back half took a toll, the way working in an environment polluted with low-level radiation would take a toll.
Hello, Mrs. Sigsby, Hello, Security Director Stackhouse. How wonderful to see you! We should get together more often. I'm sorry about the circumstances that have brought you here today, however.
He bent and patted the canvas bundle containing Maureen Alverson, then touched the corner of his mouth as if patting at a cold sore only he could see or feel. In the midst of life, cetera, cetera.
We need to make this quick,
Stackhouse said. Meaning, Mrs. Sigsby supposed, we have to get out of here. She quite concurred. This was where the real work was done, and Doctors Heckel and Jekyll, real name Joanne James, were heroes for doing it. But that didn't make it any easier to be here. She could already feel the atmosphere of the place. It was like being in a low-level electrical field.
Yes, of course you do. The work never ends. Wheels within wheels, big fleas with little fleas to bite 'em. Don't I know? Right this way.
From the lounge, with its ugly chairs, equally ugly sofa, and elderly flat screen, they entered a hall with a thick blue carpet on the floor. In back half, the children sometimes fell down and bumped their valuable little heads. The trolley's wheels left tracks in the nap. This looked much like a corridor on the residence level of front half, except for the locks on the doors, which were all shut. From behind one of them, Mrs. Sigsby heard pounding and muffled cries of,
"Let me out!"
and,
"At least give me a fucking aspirin!"
"Iris Stanhope," Heckel said. "She's not feeling well today, I'm afraid. On the upside, several of our other recent arrivals are holding up remarkably well. We're having a movie this evening, you know, and fireworks tomorrow."
He giggled and touched the corner of his mouth, reminding Mrs. Sigsby grotesquely of Shirley Temple. She brushed at her hair to make sure it was still in place. It was, of course. What she was feeling, that low buzz along her exposed skin, the sense that her eyeballs were vibrating in their sockets, wasn't electricity. They passed the screening room with its dozen or so plush seats. Sitting in the front row were Kalisha Benson, Nick Wilholm, and George Iris. They were wearing their red and blue singlets. The Benson girl was sucking on a candy cigarette. Wilholm was smoking a real one, the air around his head wreathed with gray smoke. Iris was rubbing lightly at his temples. Benson and Iris turned to look at them as they rolled past with their canvas-wrapped burden. Wilholm just went on staring at the blank movie screen. A lot of steam has been taken out of that hot dog, Mrs. Sigsby thought with satisfaction. The cafeteria was beyond the screening room, on the other side of the corridor. It was much smaller than the one in front half. There were always more children here, but the longer they stayed in back half, the less they ate. Mrs. Sigsby supposed an English major might call that irony. Three kids were currently present, two slurping up what looked like oatmeal, the other, a girl of about 12, simply sitting with a full bowl in front of her. But when she saw them passing with the trolley, she brightened.
"Hi, what have you got there? Is it a dead person?"
"It is, isn't it? Was her name Morris? That's a funny name for a girl. Maybe it's Maureen. Can I see? Are her eyes open?"
"That's Donna," Heckel said. "Ignore her. She'll be at the movie tonight, but pretty soon I expect she'll be moving on. Maybe later this week. Greener pastures, cetera, cetera, you know."
Mrs. Sigsby did know. There was front half, there was back half, and there was the back half of back half. The end of the line. She put her hand to her hair again, still in place. Of course it was. She thought of a tricycle she'd had as a very young child, the warm squirt of urine in her pants as she rode it up and down the driveway. She thought of broken shoelaces. She thought of her first car.
It was a Valium,
the girl named Donna screamed. She leaped up, knocking her chair over. The other two children looked at her dully, one with oatmeal dripping from his chin.
"A Plymouth Valium, I know that. Oh God, I want to go home. Oh God, stop my head."
Two caretakers in red scrubs appeared from Mrs. Sigsby didn't know where. Nor did she care. They grabbed the girl by her arms.
"That's right. Take her back to her room," Heckel said. "No pills, though.
We need her tonight. Donna Gibson, who had once shared girl secrets with Kalisha when they were both still in front half, began to scream and struggle. The caretakers led her away with the toes of her sneakers brushing the carpet. The broken thoughts in Mrs. Sigsby's mind first dimmed, then faded. The buzz along her skin, even in the fillings of her teeth, remained, however. Over here it was constant, like the buzz of the fluorescent lights in the corridor.
All right?
Stackhouse asked Mrs. Sigsby. Yes. Just get me out of here.
I feel it too, if it's any comfort.
It wasn't. Trevor, can you explain to me why bodies bound for the crematorium have to be rolled right through these children's living quarters?
There are tons of beans in Beantown, Stackhouse replied.
What? Mrs. Sigsby asked. What did you say? Stackhouse shook his head as if to clear it.
I'm sorry. That came into my head.
Yes, yes,
Hallis said. There are a lot of, shall we say, loose transmissions in the air today.
I know what it was,
Stackhouse said.
I had to get it out, that's all. It felt like...
Choking on food, Dr. Hallis said matter-of-factly. The answer to your question, Mrs. Sigsby, is... Nobody knows. He tittered and touched the corner of his mouth. Just get me out of here, she thought again. Where is Dr. James, Dr. Hallis? In her quarters. Not feeling well today, I'm afraid, but she sends her regards.
Hopes you're well, fit as a fiddle, in the pink, cetera, cetera.
He smiled and did the Shirley Temple thing again. Ain't I cute?
8.
In the screening room, Kalisha plucked the cigarette from Nikki's fingers, took a final puff from the filterless stub, dropped it to the floor, stepped on it. Then she put an arm around his shoulders. Bad? I've had worse. The movie will make it better. Yeah, but there's always tomorrow. Now I know why my dad was so butt ugly when he had a hangover. How about you, Shaw? Doing okay? And she was. Just a low throb over her left eye. Tonight it would be gone. Tomorrow it would be back. And not low. Tomorrow it would be pain that would make the hangover suffered by Nikki's dad and her own parents from time to time look like fun in the sun. A steady pounding thud, as if some demonic elf were imprisoned in her head, hammering at her skull in an effort to get out. Even that, she knew, wasn't as bad as it could be. Nikki's headaches were worse. Iris's worse still. And it took longer and longer for the pain to go away. George was the lucky one. In spite of his strong TK, he had so far felt almost no pain at all. An ache in his temples, he said, and at the back of his skull. But it would get worse. It always did, at least until it was finally over. And then? Ward A. The drone. The hum. The back half of back half. Kalisha didn't look forward to it yet. The idea of being erased as a person still horrified her, but that would change. For Iris, it already had. Most of the time, she looked like a zombie on The Walking Dead. Helen Sims had pretty much articulated Kalisha's feelings about Ward A when she said anything was better than the Stasi lights and a screaming headache that never stopped. George leaned forward, looking at her across Nick with bright eyes that were still relatively pain-free.
He got out, he whispered. Concentrate on that, and hold on.
We will, Kalisha said. Won't we, Nick?
We'll try, Nick said and managed a smile. Although the idea of a guy as horrible at horse as Lukey Ellis bringing the cavalry is pretty far-fetched.
He may be bad at horse, but he's good at chess, George said. Don't count him out. One of the red caretakers appeared in the open doors of the screening room. The caretakers in front half wore name tags, but down here no one did. Down here the caretakers were interchangeable. There were no techs either. Only the two back half doctors and sometimes Dr. Hendricks, Heckle Jekyll and Donkey Kong. The terrible trio.
Free time is over,
If you're not going to eat, go back to your rooms. The old Nicky might have told this overmuscled lowbrow to go fuck himself. The new version just got to his feet, staggering and grabbing a seat back to keep his balance. It broke Kalisha's heart to see him this way. What had been taken from Nicky was in some ways worse than murder. In many ways. Come on, she said. We'll go together. Right, George? Well, George said, I was planning to catch a matinee of Jersey Boys this afternoon, but since you insist. Here we are. The three fucked up musketeers, Kalisha thought. Out in the hall, the drone was much stronger. Yes, she knew Luke was out, Avery had told her, and that was good. The complacent assholes didn't even know he was gone yet, which was better. But the headaches made hope seem less hopeful. Even when they let up, you were waiting for them to come back, which was its own special brand of hell. And the drone, coming from Ward A, made hope seem irrelevant, which was awful. She had never felt so lonely, so cornered. But I have to hold on for as long as I can, she thought. No matter what they do to us with those lights and those goddamn movies, I have to hold on. I have to hold on to my mind. They walked slowly down the hall under the eye of the caretaker, not like children, but like invalids or old people, whiling away their final weeks in an unpleasant hospice. 9. Led by Dr. Everett Hallis, Mrs. Sigsbee and Stackhouse walked past the closed doors marked Ward A, Stackhouse rolling the trolley. There were no shouts or screams coming from behind those closed doors, but that sense of being in an electrical field was even stronger. It raced over her skin like invisible mouse feet. Stackhouse felt it too. The hand not busy pushing Maureen Alverson's makeshift beer was rubbing his smooth, bald dome.
To me, it always feels like cobwebs, he said.
Then to Heckle,
you don't feel it?
I'm used to it, he said and touched the corner of his mouth. It's a process of assimilation.
He stopped.
No, that's not the right word. Acclimation, I think. Or is it acclimatization? Could be either.
Mrs. Sigsbee was struck by a curiosity that was almost whimsical. Dr. Hallis, when's your birthday? Do you remember?
September 9th. And I know what you're thinking.
He looked back over his shoulder at the doors with Ward A on them in red, then at Mrs. Sigsbee.
I'm fine, howsomever.
September 9th, she said. That would make you, what, a Libra?
Aquarius,
Heckle said, giving her a roguish look that seemed to say, you do not fool me so easily, my lady.
When the moon is in the seventh house and Mercury aligns with Mars, cetera, cetera. Doc, Mr. Stackhouse, low bridge here.
They passed along a short, dim hallway, descended a flight of stairs with Stackhouse breaking the trolley in front and Mrs. Sigsbee controlling it from behind, and came to another closed door. Heckle used his key card and then entered a circular room that was uncomfortably warm. There was no furniture, but on one wall was a framed sign, Remember, these were heroes. It was under a dirty smeared glass that badly needed a dose of Windex. On the far side of the room, halfway up a rough cement wall, was a steel hatch, as if for an industrial meat locker. To the left of this was a small readout screen, currently blank. To the right was a pair of buttons, one red and one green. In here, the broken thoughts and fragments of memory that had troubled Mrs. Sigsbee ceased, and the fugitive headache which had been hovering at her temples lifted a bit. That was good, but she couldn't wait to be out. She seldom visited back half because her presence was unnecessary. The commander of an army rarely needed to visit the front lines as long as the war was going well. And even though she felt better, being in this bare round room was still flat out horrible. Hallis also seemed better, no longer Heckle, but the man who had spent 25 years as an army doctor and won a Bronze Star. He had straightened, and he had stopped touching his finger to the side of his mouth. His eyes were clear, his questions concise.
Is she wearing jewelry?
No, Mrs. Sigsby said, thinking of Alverson's missing wedding ring.
I may assume she's dressed?
Of course. Mrs. Sigsby felt obscurely offended by the question.
Have you checked her pockets?
She looked at Stackhouse. He shook his head.
Do you want to? This is your only chance if you do.
Mrs. Sigsby considered the idea and dismissed it. The woman had left her suicide note on the bathroom wall, and her purse would be in her locker. That would need checking, just as a matter of routine. But she wasn't going to unwrap the housekeeper's body and expose that protruding, impudent tongue again just to find a chapstick, a roll of Tums, and a few wadded-up Kleenex. Not me. What about you, Trevor? Stackhouse shook his head again. He had a year-round tan, but today he looked pale beneath it. The back half walk-through had taken a toll on him, too. Maybe we should do it more often, she thought. Stay in touch with the process. Then she thought of Dr. Hallis proclaiming himself an Aquarian and Stackhouse saying there were tons of beans in Beantown. She decided that staying in touch with the process was a really bad idea. And by the way, did September 9th really make Hallis a Libra? That didn't seem quite right. Wasn't it Virgo? Let's do this, she said.
All righty then,
Dr. Hallis said, and flashed an ear-to-ear smile that was all Heckle. He yanked the handle of the stainless steel door and swung it open. Beyond was blackness, a smell of cooked meat, and a sooty conveyor belt that angled down into darkness. That sign needs to be cleaned off, Mrs. Sigsby thought. And that belt needs to be scrubbed before it gets clogged and breaks down. More carelessness.
I hope you don't need help lifting her, Heckle said, still wearing his game show host smile. I'm afraid I'm feeling rather weakly today. Didn't eat my Wheaties this morning.
Stackhouse lifted the wrapped body and placed it on the belt. The bottom fold of the canvas dropped open, revealing one shoe. Mrs. Sigsby felt an urge to turn away from that scuffed sole and quelled it.
Any final words? Hallis asked. Hail and farewell? Jenny, we hardly knew ye.
Don't be an idiot, Mrs. Sigsby said. Dr. Hallis closed the door and pushed the green button. Mrs. Sigsby heard a trundle and squeak as the dirty conveyor belt began to move. When that stopped, Hallis pushed the red button. The readout came to life, quickly jumping from 200 to 400, to 800, to 1600, and finally to 3200.
Much hotter than your average crematory, Hallis said. Also much faster, but it still takes a while. You're welcome to stick around. I could give you the full tour.
Still smiling the big smile. Not today, Mrs. Sigsby said. Far too busy.
That's what I thought. Another time, perhaps. We see you so seldom, and we're always open for business.
10. As Maureen Alverson was starting her final slide, Stevie Whipple was eating mac and cheese in the front half cafeteria. Avery Dixon grabbed him by one meaty, freckled arm.
Come out to the playground with me. I ain't done eating, Avery. I don't care, he lowered his voice. It's important.
Stevie took a final enormous bite, wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, and followed Avery. The playground was deserted except for Frida Brown, who was sitting on the asphalt surrounding the basketball hoop and drawing cartoon figures in chalk. Rather good ones, all smiling. She didn't look up as the boys passed. When they arrived at the chain-link fence, Avery pointed at a trench in the dirt and gravel. Stevie stared at it with big eyes.
What did that? Woodchuck or something?
He looked around as if he expected to see a woodchuck. Possibly rabid, hiding under the trampoline or crouching beneath the picnic table.
Wasn't a woodchuck, nope, Avery said.
I bet you could squiggle right through there, Aves. Make an escape.
Don't think it hasn't crossed my mind, Avery thought. But I'd get lost in the woods. Even if I didn't, the boat is gone. Never mind. You have to help me fill it in.
Why?
Just because. And don't say escape. It sounds ignorant.
S, Stevie. Escape.
Which is just what his friend had done. God love and bless him. Where was he now? Avery had no idea. He'd lost touch.
Escape, Stevie said.
Got it.
Terrific.
Now help me.
The boys got down on their knees and began to fill in the depression under the fence, scooping with their hands and raising a cloud of dust. It was hot work, and they were both soon sweating. Stevie's face was bright red.
What are you boys doing?
They looked around. It was Gladys, her usual big smile nowhere in sight.
Nothing, Avery said.
Nothing, Stevie agreed. Just playing in the dirt, you know, the dirty old dirt.
Let me see.
Move.
And when neither of them did, she kicked Avery in the side.
Ow!
He cried and curled up.
Ow, that hurt!
Stevie said, what are you, on the rag or some?
Then he got his own kick, high up on the shoulder.
Gladys looked at the trench, only partially filled in, then at Frida, still absorbed in her artistic endeavors.
Did you do this?
Frida shook her head without looking up.
Gladys pulled her walkie from the pocket of her white pants and keyed it.
Mr. Stackhouse? This is Gladys for Mr. Stackhouse?
There was a pause, then...
This is Stackhouse, go.
I think you need to come out to the playground as soon as possible. There's something you need to see. Maybe it's nothing, but I don't like it.
11. After notifying the security chief, Gladys called Winona to take the two boys back to their rooms. They were to stay there until further notice.
I don't know nothing about that hole, Stevie said sulkily. I thought a woodchuck done it.
Winona told him to shut up and herded the boys back inside.
Stackhouse arrived with Mrs. Sigsby.
She bent and he squatted, first looking at the dip under the chain link, then at the fence itself.
Nobody could crawl under there, Mrs. Sigsby said. Well, maybe Dixon, but he's not much bigger than those Wilcox twins were. But no one else.
Stackhouse scooped away the loose mix of rocks and dirt the two boys had put back in, deepening the dip to a trench.
Are you sure of that?
Mrs. Sigsby realized she was biting at her lip and made herself stop.
The idea is ridiculous, she thought. We have cameras. We have microphones. We have the caretakers and the janitors and the housekeepers. We have security. All to take care of a bunch of kids so terrified they wouldn't say boo to a goose. Of course, there was Wilhelm, who definitely would say boo to a goose, and there had been a few others like him over the years. But still...
Julia.
Very low.
What?
Get down here with me.
She started to do it, then saw the brown girl staring at them.
Get inside, she snapped. This second!
Frida went in a hurry, dusting off her chalky hands, leaving her smiling cartoon people behind. As the girl entered the lounge, Mrs. Sigsby saw a small cluster of children gawking out.
Where were the caretakers when you needed them?
In the break room, swapping stories with one of the extraction teams? Telling dirty joke?
Julia!
She dropped to one knee, wincing when a sharp piece of gravel bit into her.
There's blood on this fence. See it?
She didn't want to, but she did.
Yes, that was blood. Dried to maroon, but definitely blood.
Now look over here.
He poked a finger through one of the chain-link diamonds, pointing at a partially uprooted bush. There was blood on that, too. As Mrs. Sigsby looked at those few spots, spots that were outside, her stomach dropped, and for one alarming moment, she thought she was going to wet her pants, as she had on that long-ago trike. She thought of the Zero Phone and saw her life as head of the Institute, because that's what it was, not her job, but her life. Disappearing into it. What would the lisping man on the other end say if she had to call and tell him that, in what was supposed to be the most secret and secure facility in the country, not to mention the most vital facility in the country, a child had escaped by going under a fence. They would say she was done, of course. Done and dusted.
The residents are all here, she said in a hoarse whisper.
She grasped Stackhouse's wrist, her fingernails biting into his skin. He didn't seem to notice. He was still staring at the partially uprooted bush as if hypnotized. This was as bad for him as for her. Not worse. There was no worse, but just as bad.
Trevor, they are all here. I checked.
I think you better check again. Don't you?
She had her walkie this time. Thoughts of locking the barn door after the livestock was stolen flashed through her mind, and she keyed it.
Zeke, this is Mrs. Sigsby for Zeke.
You better be there, Ioannidis. You just better.
He was.
This is Zeke, Mrs. Sigsby. I've been checking up on Alverson. Mr. Stackhouse told me to since Jerry's off and Andy's not here. And I reached her next door,
Never mind that now. Look at the locator blips again for me.
Okay.
He sounded suddenly cautious. Must have heard the strain in my voice, she thought.
Hold on. Everything's running slow this morning. Couple more seconds.
She felt as if she would scream. Stackhouse was still peering through the fence, as if expecting a magic fucking hobbit to appear and explain the whole thing.
Okay,
Zeke said.
41 residents, still perfect attendance.
Relief cooled her face like a breeze. All right, that's good. That's very... Stackhouse took the walkie from her.
Where are they currently? Still 28 in back half. Now 4 in the east wing lounge. 3 in the calf. 2 in their rooms. 3 in the hall.
Those 3 would be Dixon, Whipple, and the artist girl, Mrs. Sigsby thought.
Plus 1 in the playground.
Zeke finished.
41, like I said.
Wait 1, Zeke.
Stackhouse looked at Mrs. Sigsby.
You see a kid in the playground?
She didn't answer him. She didn't need to. Stackhouse raised the walkie again.
Zeke?
Go, Mr. Stackhouse. Right here.
Can you pinpoint the exact location of the kid in the playground?
Let me zoom. There's a button for that.
Don't bother, Mrs. Sigsby said. She had spotted an object glittering in the early afternoon sun. She walked onto the basketball court, stooped at the foul line, and picked it up. She returned to her security chief and held out her hand. In her palm was most of an earlobe with the tracker button still embedded in it.
12. The front half residents were told to return to their rooms and stay there. If any were caught in the hall, they would be severely punished. The Institute security force totaled just 4, counting Stackhouse himself. 2 of these men were in the Institute village and came quickly. Using the golf cart track Maureen had expected Luke to find, and which he had missed by less than 100 feet. The 3rd member of Stackhouse's team was in Denison Riverbend. Stackhouse had no intention of waiting for her to turn up. Denny Williams and Robin Lex of the Ruby Red team were on site, though, waiting for their next assignment and perfectly willing to be drafted. They were joined by 2 wide bodies, Joe Brinks and Chad Greenlee.
The Minnesota boy, Denny said, once this makeshift search party was assembled and the tale was told.
The one we brought in last month.
That's right,
Stackhouse agreed.
The Minnesota boy.
And you say he ripped the tracker right out of his ear?
Robin asked.
The cut's a little smoother than that. Used a knife, I think.
Took balls either way, Denny said.
I'll have his balls when we catch up to him, Joe said.
He doesn't fight like Wilhelm did, but he's got a fuck you look in his eyes.
He'll be wandering around in the woods, so lost he'll probably hug us when we find him, Chad said.
He paused.
If we find him. Lots of trees out there.
He was bleeding from his ear and probably all down his back from going under the fence, Stackhouse said. Must have got it on his hands, too. We'll follow the blood as far as we can.
It'd be good if we had a dog, Denny Williams said. A bloodhound or a good old blue tick.
It would be good if he'd never gotten out in the first place, Robin said.
Under the fence, huh? She almost laughed, then saw Stackhouse's drawn face and furious eyes and reconsidered.
Rafe Pullman and John Walsh, the two security guys from the village, arrived just then. Stackhouse said, "We are not going to kill him, understand that, but we are going to zap the living shit out of the little son of a bitch when we find him." "If we find him," Chad the caretaker repeated. "We'll find him," Stackhouse said. "Because if we don't," he thought, "I'm toast. This whole place might be toast."
"I'm going back to my office," Mrs. Sixby said.
Stackhouse caught her by the elbow. "And do what?"
"Think."
"That's good. Think all you want, but no calls. Are we agreed on that?" Mrs. Sixby looked at him with contempt, but the way she was biting her lips suggested she might also be afraid. If so, that made two of them.
"Of course."
But when she got to her office, the blessed, air-conditioned silence of her office, she found thinking was hard. Her eyes kept straying to the locked drawer of her desk, as if it wasn't a phone inside, but a hand grenade.
13. 3 o'clock in the afternoon. No news from the men hunting for Luke Ellis in the woods. Plenty of communications, yes, but no news. Every member of the Institute staff had been notified of the escape. It was all hands on deck. Some had joined the searchers. Others were combing the Institute village, searching all empty quarters, looking for the boy or at least some sign that he'd been there. All personal vehicles were accounted for. The golf carts the employees sometimes used to get around were all where they belonged. Their stringers in Denison Riverbend, including two members of the town's small police force, had been alerted and given Ellis's description, but there had been no sightings. With Alverson, there was news. Ioannidis had shown initiative and guile of which Jerry Simons and Andy Fellows, their IT techs, would have been incapable. First, using Google Earth and then a phone locator app, Zeke had gotten in touch with Alverson's next-door neighbor in the little Vermont town where Alverson still maintained a residence. He represented himself to this neighbor as an IRS agent, and she bought it without a single question. Showing no signs of the reticence Yankees were supposedly famous for, she told him that Maureen had asked her to witness several documents the last time Mo had been home. A woman lawyer had been present. The documents were addressed to several collection agencies. The lawyer called the documents C and D orders, which the neighbor rightly took to mean cease and desist.
"Those letters were all about her husband's credit cards,"
the neighbor lady told Zeke.
"Mo didn't explain, but she didn't need to. I wasn't born yesterday. Handling that deadbeat's bills is what she was doing. If the IRS can sue her for that, you better move fast. She looked sick as hell."
Mrs. Sixby thought the Vermont neighbor had it right. The question was why Alverson would do it that way. It was carrying coals to Newcastle. All Institute employees knew that if they got into any kind of financial jam, gambling was the most common, they could count on loans that were next door to interest-free. That part of the benefits package was explained at every new employee's intake orientation. It really wasn't a benefit at all, but a protection. People who were in debt could be tempted to sell secrets. The easy explanation for such behavior was pride, maybe combined with shame at having been taken advantage of by her runaway husband. But Mrs. Sixby didn't like it. The woman had been nearing the end of her life and must have known that for some time. She had decided to clean her hands, and taking money from the organization that had dirtied them was not the way to start. That felt right, or close to right, anyway. It fit with Alverson's reference to hell. That bitch helped him escape, Mrs. Sixby thought. Of course she did. It was her idea of atonement. But I can't question her about it. She made sure of that. Of course she did. She knows our methods. So what do I do? What will I do if that too-smart-for-his-own-good boy isn't back here before dark? She knew the answer, and was sure Trevor did, too. She would have to take the Zero phone out of its locked drawer and hit all three of the white buttons. The lisping man would answer. When she told him that a resident had escaped for the first time in the Institute's history, had dug his way out in the middle of the night under the fence What would that person say? Gosh, I'm sorry. That's too bad? Don't worry about it. Like hell. Think, she told herself. Think. 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 Who might the troublesome housekeeper have told? For that matter, who might Ellis have Fuck! Fuck! It was right in front of her, and had been ever since discovering the hole under the fence. She sat up straight in her chair, eyes wide, the Zero phone out of her mind for the first time since Stackhouse had called in to report the blood trail had disappeared just 50 yards into the woods. She powered up her computer and found the file she wanted. She clicked, and a video began to play. Alverson, Ellis, and Dixon standing by the snack machines.
We can talk here. There's a mic, but it hasn't worked for years.
Luke Ellis did most of the talking. He voiced concern about those twins and the crossboy. Alverson soothed him. Dixon stood by, saying little, just scratching his arms and yanking at his nose.
Jesus Christ,
Stackhouse had said.
If you have to pick it, go on and pick it.
Only now, looking at this video with new eyes, Mrs. Sigsby saw what had really been going on. She closed her laptop and thumbed her intercom. Rosalind, I want to see the Dixon boy. Have Tony and Winona bring him. Right away. 14. Avery Dixon, dressed in a Batman t-shirt and dirty shorts that displayed his scabby knees, stood in front of Mrs. Sigsby's desk, looking at her with frightened eyes. Small to begin with, and now flanked by Winona and Tony, he didn't look 10. He looked barely old enough for first grade. Mrs. Sigsby offered him a thin smile. I should have gotten to you much sooner, Mr. Dixon. I must be slipping.
Yes, ma'am,
Avery whispered. So you agree? You think I'm slipping?
No, ma'am.
Avery's tongue flicked out and wet his lips. No nose pulling, though. Not today. Mrs. Sigsby leaned forward, hands clasped. If I have been, the slippage is over now. Changes will be made. But first it's important, imperative, that we bring Luke back home.
Yes, ma'am.
She nodded. We agree, and that's good. A good start. So where did he go?
I don't know, ma'am.
I think you do. You and Stephen Whipple were filling in the hole he escaped through, which was stupid. You should have left it alone.
We thought a woodchuck made it, ma'am.
Nonsense. You know exactly who made it. Your friend Luke. Now, she spread her hands on her desk and smiled at him. He's a smart boy, and smart boys don't just plunge off into the woods. Going under the fence might have been his idea, but he needed Alverson to give him the lay of the land on the other side of it. She gave you the directions piece by piece every time you yanked on your nose. Beamed it right into your talented little head, didn't she? Later on, you gave it to Ellis. There's no point in denying it, Mr. Dixon. I've seen the video of your conversation. It is, if you don't mind a silly old lady making a joke, as plain as the nose on your face. I should have realized it sooner. And Trevor, she thought, he saw it too, and also should have seen what was going on. If there's a comprehensive debriefing when this is over, how blind we will look. Now tell me where he went.
I really don't know.
You're shifting your eyes around, Mr. Dixon. That's what liars do. Look straight at me. Otherwise, Tony is going to twist your arm behind your back, and that will hurt. She nodded at Tony. He grabbed one of Avery's thin wrists. Avery looked straight at her. It was hard because her face was thin and scary. A mean teacher's face that said, "Tell me everything." But he did it. Tears began to well up and roll down his cheeks. He'd always been a crier. His two older sisters had called him Little Crybaby Cry, and in the schoolyard at recess he had been anybody's punching bag. The playground here was better. He missed his mother and father, missed them bad, but at least he had friends. Harry had pushed him down, but then had been a friend. at least until he died. Until they killed him with one of their stupid tests. Shaw and Helen were gone, but the new girl Frida was nice to him and had let him win at horse. Only once, but still. And Luke, he was the best of all. The best friend Avery had ever had. Where did Alverson tell him to go, Mr. Dixon? What was the plan? I don't know. Mrs. Sigsby nodded to Tony, who twisted Avery's arm behind his back and hoisted his wrist almost to his shoulder blade. The pain was incredible. Avery screamed. Where did he go? What was the plan?
I don't know!
Let him go, Tony. Tony did so, and Avery collapsed to his knees, sobbing.
That really hurt. Don't hurt me anymore. Please don't.
He thought of adding, it's not fair, but what did these people care about what was fair? Nothing. That was what. I don't want to, Mrs. Sigsby said. This was a thin truth at best. The thicker one was that years spent in this office had inured her to the pain of children. And while the sign in the crematorium was right, they were heroes, no matter how reluctant their heroism might be. Some of them could try one's patience. Sometimes, until one's patience snapped.
I don't know where you went, honest!
When people have to say they're being honest, that means they're not. I've been around the block a few times, and I know that. So tell me, where did he go, and what was the plan?
I don't know!
Tony, lift up his shirt. Winona, your taser, medium power.
No!
Avery screamed, trying to pull away.
No zapstick! Please, no zapstick!
Tony caught him around the middle and lifted his shirt. Winona positioned her zapstick just above Avery's belly button and triggered it. Avery shrieked. His legs jerked, and piss watered the carpet. Where did he go, Mr. Dixon? The boy's face was blotchy and snotty. There were dark circles beneath his eyes. He had wet his pants, and still the little runt was holding out. Mrs. Sigsby could hardly believe it. Where did he go, and what was the plan?
I don't know.
Winona? Again. Medium power.
Ma'am, are you sh-
A little higher this time, if you please. Just below the solar plexus. Avery's arms were greased with sweat, and he wriggled out of Tony's grip, almost making a rotten situation even worse. He'd have gone flying around her office like a bird trapped in a garage, knocking things over and bouncing off the walls. But Winona tripped him and pulled him to his feet by his arms. So it was Tony who used the taser. Avery screamed and went limp. Is he out? Mrs. Sigsby asked.
If he is, get Dr. Evans in here to give him a shot. We need answers fast.
Tony grabbed one of Avery's cheeks, plump when he'd come here, much thinner now, and twisted it. Avery's eyes flew open.
He's not out,
Mrs. Sigsby said. Mr. Dixon, this pain is stupid and unnecessary. Tell me what I want to know, and it will stop. Where did he go? What was the plan?
I don't know, Avery whispered. I really, really, really don't know.
Winona, please remove Mr. Avery's pants and apply your taser to his testes. Full power. Although Winona was as apt to slap a sass box resident as look at him, she was clearly unhappy with this command. Nevertheless, she reached for the waistband of his pants. That was when Avery broke.
Okay, okay, I'll tell. Just don't hurt me anymore.
That is a relief for both of us.
Maureen told him to go through the woods. She said he might find a track for golf carts, but to keep going straight, even if he didn't. She said he'd see lights, especially a bright yellow one. She said when he got to the houses, he should follow the fence until he saw a scarf tied to a bush or a tree. I don't remember which. She said there was a path behind it, or a road. I don't remember that either. But she said it would take him to the river. She said there was a boat.
He stopped. Mrs. Sigsby gave him a nod and a benign smile. But inside, her heart was beating triple time. This was both good news and bad. Stackhouse's search party could stop floundering around in the woods, but a boat?
Ellis had gotten to the river, and he was hours ahead of them.
Then what, Mr. Dixon? Where did she tell him to get off the river? The Bend, am I right? Denison River Bend?
Avery shook his head and made himself look directly at her, all wide eyes and terrified honesty.
No, she said that was too close. She said to keep on the river as far as Presque Isle.
Very good, Mr. Dixon. You can go back to your room. But if I should find out that you've lied,
I'll be in trouble,
Avery said, wiping at the tears on his cheeks with trembling hands. At that, Mrs. Sigsby actually laughed.
You read my mind, she said.
15. 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Ellis gone at least 18 hours, maybe longer. The playground cams didn't record, so it was impossible to tell for sure. Mrs. Sigsby and Stackhouse were in Mrs. Sigsby's office, monitoring developments and listening for reports from their stringers. They had these all over the country. For the most part, the Institute stringers did no more than groundwork, keeping an eye on children with high BDNF scores and compiling information on their friends, family, neighborhoods, school situations, and their homes, of course. Everything about their homes, especially alarm systems. All that background was useful to the extraction teams when the time came. They also kept an eye out for special children not already on the Institute's radar. These did show up from time to time. BDNF testing, along with the Heelstick PKU and the Apgar score, was routine for infants born in American hospitals. But of course, not all babies were born in hospitals, and plenty of parents, such as the ever more vocal anti-vaxxer contingent, forwent the tests. These stringers had no idea to whom they were reporting, or to what purpose. Many assumed, incorrectly, that it was some kind of U.S. government Big Brother thing. Most simply banked the extra income of $500 a month, made their reports when reports had to be made, and asked no questions. Of course, every now and then one would ask questions, and that one would discover that as well as killing cats, curiosity killed their monthly dividend. The thickest concentration of stringers, almost 50, was in the area surrounding the Institute, and tracking talented children was not their major concern. The chief job of these stringers was to listen for people asking the wrong questions. They were tripwires, an early warning system. Stackhouse was careful to alert half a dozen in Denison Riverbend, just in case the Dixon boy was mistaken or lying.
He wasn't lying. I would have known, Mrs. Sigsby insisted.
But most he sent to the Presque Isle area. One of them was tasked with contacting the PI police and telling them that he was quite sure he'd seen a boy who had been in a news story on CNN. This boy, according to the news, was wanted for questioning in the murders of his parents. His name was Luke Ellis. The stringer told the police he wasn't positive it was that kid, but it sure did look like him, and he'd asked for money in a threatening, disjointed way. Both Mrs. Sigsby and Stackhouse knew that having the police pick up their wandering boy wasn't the ideal solution to their problems, but police could be handled. Besides, anything Ellis told them would be dismissed as the ravings of an unbalanced child. Cell phones didn't work in the Institute or in the village, indeed not for a 2-mile radius, so the searchers used walkies, and there were landlines. Now the one on Mrs. Sigsby's desk rang. Stackhouse grabbed it.
What? Who am I talking to?
It was Dr. Felicia Richardson, who had spelled Zeke in the comm room. She had been eager to do it. Her ass was also on the line, a fact she fully grasped.
I've got one of our stringers on hold, guy named Gene Levesque. He says he found the boat Ellis used. Want me to transfer him to you?
Immediately.
Mrs. Sigsby was standing in front of Stackhouse now, hands raised, lips forming the word,
What?
Stackhouse ignored her. There was a click, and Levesque came on the line. He had a St. John Valley accent thick enough to cut pulpwood. Stackhouse had never seen him,
but pictured a tanned old guy under a hat with a bunch of fishing lures stuck in the brim.
Found that boat, me.
So I'm told.
Where? She'd come aground on a bank about 5 miles upriver from Presque Isle. Ship quite a bit of water, she did. But the handle of the oar, just one oar, was prop on the seat. Left it right where it was. Didn't call nobody. There's blood on the oar. Tell you what, there's a little bit of rapids a little further up. If that boy you looking for wasn't used to boats, especially a little one like that,
it might have spilled him out, Stackhouse finished. Stay where you are. I'm going to send a couple of guys, and thank you.
What you pay me for,
Levesque said.
Don't suppose you can tell me what he do.
Stackhouse killed the call, which answered that particular foolish question, and filled in Mrs. Sigsby. With any luck, the little bastard drowned and someone will find his body tonight or tomorrow. But we can't count on being that lucky. I want to get Rafe and John, all I've got for security, and that's going to change when this is over, to downtown Presque Isle, ASAP. If Ellis is on foot, that's where he'll go first. If he hitches a ride, either the state police or some towny cop will pick him up and hold him. He's the crazy kid who killed his parents, after all, then ran all the way to Maine.
Are you as hopeful as you sound?
She was honestly curious. No.
16. The residents were allowed out of their rooms for dinner. It was, by and large, an outwardly silent meal. There were several caretakers and techs present, circling like sharks. They were clearly on edge, more than ready to strike or zap anyone who gave them lip. Yet in that quiet running secretly behind it was a nervous elation so strong that it made Freda Brown feel slightly drunk. There had been an escape. All of the kids were glad, and none of them wanted to show it. Was she glad? Freda wasn't so sure. Part of her was, but... Avery was sitting beside her, burying his 2 hot dogs in baked beans, then digging them up, interring them and exhuming them. Freda wasn't as bright as Luke Ellis, but she was plenty smart and knew what interring and exhuming meant. What she didn't know was what would happen if Luke tattled about what was going on here to someone who believed him. Specifically, what would happen to them? Would they be freed? Sent home to their parents? She was sure it was what these kids wanted to believe, hence that secret current, but Freda had her doubts. She was only 14, but she was already a hardened cynic. Her cartoon people smiled. She rarely did. Also, she knew something the rest of them didn't. Avery had been taken to Mrs. Sigsby's office, and there he had undoubtedly spilled his guts, which meant Luke wasn't going to get away. Are you going to eat that shizzle or just play with it? Avery pushed the plate away and stood up. Ever since coming back from Mrs. Sigsby's office, he had looked like a boy who had seen a ghost. There's apple pie a la mode and chocolate pudding for dessert on the menu, Freda said. And it's not like home, mine anyway, where you have to eat everything on your plate to get it.
Not hungry, Avery said and left the cafeteria.
But 2 hours later, after the kids had been sent back to their rooms, the lounge and canteen had both been declared off-limits this evening, and the door to the playground was locked, he padded down to Frida's room in his jammies, said he was hungry, and asked if she had any tokens. Are you kidding? Freda asked. I just barely got here. She actually had 3, but she wasn't giving them to Avery. She liked him, but not that much.
Oh, okay.
Go to bed. You won't be hungry while you're asleep, and when you wake up, it'll be breakfast.
Can I sleep with you, Freda, since Luke's gone?
You should be in your room. You could get us in trouble.
I don't want to sleep alone. They hurt me. They gave me electric shocks. What if they come back and hurt me some more? They might, if they find out.
What?
Nothing.
She considered. She considered many things, actually. An ace considerer was Freda Brown of Springfield, Missouri.
Well, okay. Get into bed. I'm going to stay up a while longer. There's a show on TV about wild animals I want to see. Did you know some wild animals eat their babies?
Do they?
Avery looked stricken.
That's awful sad.
She patted his shoulder. Mostly they don't.
Oh. Oh, good.
Yes. Now get into bed and don't talk. I hate people talking when I'm trying to watch a show. Avery got into bed. Frida watched the wild animal show. An alligator fought with a lion. Or maybe it was a crocodile. Either way, it was interesting. And Avery was interesting. Because Avery had a secret. If she had been a TP as strong as he was, she would have known it already. As it was, she only knew it was there. When she was sure he was asleep, he snored, polite little boy snores, she turned out the lights, got into bed with him, and shook him.
Avery!
He grunted and tried to turn away from her. She wouldn't let him.
Avery, where did Luke go?
Prekile, he muttered. She had no idea what Prekile was and didn't care because it wasn't the truth.
Come on, where did he go? I won't tell.
Up the red steps,
Avery said. He was still mostly asleep. Probably thought he was dreaming this.
What red steps?
She whispered it in his ear. He didn't answer, and when he tried to turn away from her this time, Frida let him. Because she had what she needed. Unlike Avery and Kalisha, at least on good days, she could not exactly read thoughts. What she had were intuitions that were probably based on thoughts, and sometimes, if a person were unusually open, like a little boy who was mostly asleep, she got brief, brilliant pictures. She lay on her back, looking up at the ceiling of her room, thinking. 17. 10 o'clock. The Institute was quiet. Sophie Turner, one of the night caretakers, was sitting at the picnic table in the playground smoking an illicit cigarette and tapping her ashes into the cap of a vitamin water bottle. Dr. Evans was beside her, with a hand on her thigh. He leaned over and kissed her neck.
Don't do that, Jimmy.